Mr. Yogi Maya, Reel 6.
The fifth experiment was to exercise to capture or to investigate security for Portland Harbour. Long story short, we were able to do so, and I was able to penetrate into the Guard Citadel to the officer's mess by climbing with another one of the rocks. And this was an enormous successful exercise. We never knew more about it, apart from that even the colonel was not called in for in the afterwards, because the fact that in an army exercise we clearly marked as enemies and so on, penetrate all this was not that we were so fantastic clever hollex, because for example that there was a boat lying, which was a wooden boat, and two of them rode through the minefields in the wooden boat and should never have been there. And others were traveling in underneath a train, hiding underneath the train, protected, and so on and so on. Anyhow,
so you proved really the security wasn't very good.
The security was not very good indeed, and there was an enormous amount of. All of us reported afterwards our own little contribution, because we all split everybody up in tasks, and we worked in our groups of four. And then more and more left, and they went to Italy. We didn't know where they went to, I don't know it now. And I was with my group, I lost my wireless operator who broke his spine in the injured his spine in parachuting. And we got a young man attached to us, so we went into what we were called our last exercise in the very, very cold winter. And we had to parachute in a snowstorm. Plus it was called off by Mexico, we had to. And he was completely mad. I said, okay, my colonel, you can't do an exercise where you leave all your footsteps in the snow. But we had to carry on with it, and there was some steel structures, and so we didn't know what it was about. Anyhow, police was involved, and as all of it was heavy entry, we were caught. And when we came back to Anderson Manor, where we were stationed, Colonel said to me, Mayor, this was an exercise. This exercise is for you. We have selected three of your Rhinelanders, and we want you to be involved in securing the bridgehead across the Rhine. And we need people. We have contact with the other side. We have contact even with German troops. All this is there. All we need now is three of you to go over in contact. That's why this exercise is taking place now. Short time after we called and said, the Virgin Green Martin has been captured. There is no need for you to carry out this exercise. And we were delighted because the chances were very small. And then we were returned to the Royal Fusiliers. And I spent my days with the Royal Fusiliers in a little wood nearby to cut down beech trees, because all officers up to major had to make a big regimental badge out of little colored stones. Well, there were so many officers, there was no work for them. My work was only in the morning to do PE for all officers. And I was returned to the ranks. That was the first thing with delight when I came back. But that was only for a few days. I was called officer cadet or something like that, and had to go back to the War Office Selection Board. And that is the end of the story, where I was told, you can get the commission you didn't get, because you exercise things, you can receive your captaincy if you sign on for another year, because we would like you to investigate youth movement in Germany and mind of Hitler Youth, and also we need a specialist with your knowledge about youth work and sport. And so I was told that they were going through all this funny way of all this election board, where you had to sit in the evening to come and to judge whether you are a gentleman and could be accepted as an officer. Anyhow, I said, no. They could make me a general. I won't go. I want to go home to my family. I do not want to go to Germany in any way whatsoever. If there's no war, I don't want to go to Germany. So I spent my last days in Norfolk Square as an instructor for German for the control commission. My commanding officer was Tilton, Tilton. He was the fashion designer, and I think he's not alive anymore. He was the queerest person I ever saw. And he ran around with battle press and on gay tests and so on, but he thought we had a jacket and nobody cared about him. And he played the soldier and he had cut his hair short and a very tall man, and he loved to be a soldier. But we had, and I had in my class anything up to, I don't know what rank, all officers, and ladies as well, all those who were supposed to go to Germany. And they had, their German was all classical German. They could quote Goethe to you, and all that, but if you asked them how to take a ticket on the bus, they didn't know how to. They all had public school German, but they had no proper German to use. So, it's funny, it sounds, we played, as I talked before, I knew how. So, pretending now we play bus today. There you saw officers playing childish games, how to be the bus conductor and so on. The next thing we built railway station. And so I tried to teach them some colloquial German which they could use. But it was an evening I went home. Then one day I was dismissed. My number came up. And I got a suit and a hat and a bit of money. And I had to sign on front of yourself. And there I left because it didn't meet me anyhow. That won the war for already, so why didn't they meet me? That's the end of the story. But about SOE in action, there is, you should say, Dale. Another one is Walter Freud. He is a grandson of Sigmund Freud. And he has published a lot about his things he loves doing it, what a hero he was. In the Association for Jewish Refugees, they have a paper that tells a story in there. And when he ran out of his story, he told the story about somebody else. But the man who really has written, I got the book here first, probably you have got it already, is called Dale, Captain Dale. Some of them carried on, he carried on afterwards.
Yeah. You know, you had left Germany after Kristallnacht.
Yeah. So
in the interim, did you know what had happened to your family? Had you family left behind in Germany?
Everything was left behind.
Yes. Did you know, were you able to trace what had happened to them?
We then had some postcards and so on, and my brother-in-law was still in Berlin till 43. He was a chemist, and they needed him. He married a doctor. And then we heard that they had left Berlin. There was one uncle who survived. He was married to a non-Jewish person who lived in Stuttgart. He was a former town architect. They both were devoted Quakers because they always went to the Quaker meetings in Quaker. They more or less, the wife was definitely not Jewish. Somehow they, he of course, again was not that type. His blue eyes and so on. He survived. He joined us later after the war. And so we knew things had happened. But we did not, I didn't know until late of the war about that people were gassed. When we heard about the concentration camp, we actually asked, could we be dropped near a camp to be there before, or at least at the time of liberation. And it was impossible to drop us because we know from other reports that it was not possible to go so low with the plane to drop people there and so on.
When do you think you heard? When would it you have known about the concentration camp?
I would think that we were maybe 44. And then also, very vaguely, you see, as a soldier, you only get rumors and stories and so on. But we heard about it. And after the war, then slowly it came through that my wife had lost father, mother, brother, sister-in-law, uncles, and so on. Since she lost over 12 people, she's the only one left. And we never spoke with our children about it. It just slowly came through. I got schooled in Germany and had 200 youngsters of the upper school. And then I said, asked the question, now, what did your grandfather tell you about the war? Silence, not one of them would say anything. So I said, well, there you are. They have probably been boxed with their badges in, but they won't talk about it, they can't wear them, because it's swastika on them, and they won't talk about it. Maybe they have good reasons, but probably by a large majority, they are honorable soldiers, but they won't talk. And you said, a little girl stood up, a little girl, 16-year-old. So let me ask you questions. What did you tell your children? Dead silence. And I said, nothing. I said, you are? I said, no. How do you tell your children that they haven't got a grandfather, a grandmother, an uncle, a cousin? Where are they all? How do you tell your children there's never an uncle, a real uncle? There's no grandmother. But what do you tell them? It's similar, I said, to sex education. You don't sit down with a child and say, now come on, explain all your effects of life. Even a family, you pick it up out of the family life slowly, and the moment is right, one sentence or another. And in the same way, you pick up what happened to your family. And by that spread over years of it, the child can take it and bear it. But it couldn't take it at once. We didn't do that intentionally. We did that by intuition. And so is my work with the boys from the camps. It's by intuition.
Yes, I'd like to ask you about that, but it's very interesting what you're saying about your own children,
yeah.
Isn't it? Did you wait until they asked you questions, why they didn't have uncle?
They waited till we said something. They may have picked it up like you picked in six, like you may have heard from other children. What happened to your grandmother? Did she also get it? So they picked up a newspaper. Slowly the picture emerges like a mosaic. And the food to that. But it's just little things you provide. Right? Like, oh, you know this napkin thing? And I tell some story about that. Right? I'm sure you know. And so that is how education takes place. Real education.
And your children, how many children do you have?
Three.
How have they taken this, the your Holocaust background?
They are now being grown up more interested because they can take it. They have read so much more. But when they were children, they also were only fleetingly interested. You know, there was somebody watching out, they had to go to a football match, or they had to do something, you see. Somehow children have an enormous vitality and egoism. Right? Who wants to listen to a story? Like a child said, a friend of mine talked to her daughter about sex, then I come here, I explain to you. And she talked and talked, and the girl looked out of the window. And the mother said, look, this is important. I said, yes, I asked you a question, Mom, but if I had known there was a long explanation with it, I would have asked you. That is the attitude of children. And people always forget it when they talk about sex education in school. Yes, that's all right, but that facts, what they say about facts of life, are not facts of life. They are facts of biology. Facts of life you pick up from other people. Life is in the classroom, it's in the street. But in the book is this information. Therefore, Peter is an excellent teacher to sex education when our two girls are pregnant or comes. Nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it. It's important, of course it's important. But it's only half the answer to the problem. And so it's the same with talking to children about the Holocaust. And I never talk about the Holocaust. I said, I have only second-hand information. I get you somebody like Dan Helfgott or others who talk to you directly. I'm governor of a school, many schools, etc. And when the headmaster just asked me, Mr. Mayor, could you talk about the Holocaust? I said, I will be there, but I will bring somebody. Right. And we have this terrible thing in this country. We have now Holocaust is on the syllabus. But for children of 13 and 14, it's too early. You have to understand history. The villain. And because I spoke in a school here, I tried to learn it now, where a 13-year-old boy said, Mr. Mayor, do you ever see somebody hanged? The desire to see is like going to the a place of horror, right? And the danger is in the museum that it becomes a chamber of horrors. Right? And that's why where I am so anxious to say it has to be built into the wall. I'm trying very hard. I talk to the what is the name of the director at the museum?
Mr. Crawford, yes.
I talked to him and said, what I would like to see is that we set up a room which is the resistance, the SOE, the partisans, so that children see people have also fought the Nazis, volunteered the Nazis, got executed by the Nazis. There was resistance. It was not only suffering. And that is so important. But if you have a chain of horrors, then you're freed completely. The kids come in and say, oh, haven't you got a spare leg lying or something? That is the worst which you can do, to have a chamber of horrors. But if you have a room of resistance, the Belgian room is a bit too much of a chamber of horror. Which exists now, the Belgian room. And I do feel it ought to be completely set in pro and contra. Those people couldn't fight, but some did. But those who could did, out there, they were so. And that is a picture, so that people have respect for their victims. Because all that, but why didn't they do something about it? If I would have, I would have taken the gun of the SS and shot him or something like that. Then children's things, heroism, dreaming of heroism, like the dream of heroes. This extreme. And that is takes them. I'm gladly willing to help if they want me on to build up this for some people who has a feel for it and don't have chambers of horrors. And that's why I tell my story about the war and the laughter of the family and so, because it is human. I'm very often accused because I feel there is a danger that we give the Holocaust a place in history which unbalance the understanding. We ought to have about what happened in Nazi Germany. We start looking at Germany from the wrong end. We enter the Nazi problem from the dead in camps. And we haven't understood how this whole has happened until it ended there. And I think if we want kids to understand it, we have to, as I do, talk shortly about the years, how the Nazis came to power, the danger of dictatorship. I talk about inflation, unemployment, with little anecdotes. And so until they understand how the war came about. Also being honest and saying how unprepared we were and how delighted we were to lose Hitler to fight the Russians. How the Americans pleaded for time, it took them 2 years to be ready. That the Russians could only resist because they could build up behind the Euro. How they signed a treaty with the Germans to gain time. And then that Hitler, at the beginning, all he wanted was no Jews in Germany. And he thought they can go to all other countries. And then slowly feeling that this is not possible, until they came to the Enthusiasm and the extermination, which was not in Hitler's mind, because he was a very narrow-thinking man, and he couldn't imagine how difficult it is to get rid of 500,000 people and so on. And it's like a person who starts stealing and gets away with it. He progresses as a criminal. And Hitler has progressed from, as a criminal, from one who didn't take serious as a criminal at the beginning, to a mass murderer. And he was so afraid about his life all the time that in the end he had the courage to make his great farewell speech to the world at Nuremberg. What a stage was set there for him to proclaim his ideas. Goering did it. And he took the coward's way out to kill himself. That is what one must tell children. And then seeing, can you think of somebody in history who was probably similar? Ah, Nero. Yes, what did he do? He set fire to Rome. What did Hitler want to do? He wanted to destroy all German towns in front of the Russians. Sure. That is teaching. And the trouble is sometimes when people go teach the Holocaust, tell the story, very good. But I do believe that the museum, which should be a Holocaust museum, not a Shoah museum, we have told the complete story about the camps, including, say, 1 million Germans in labor camps all over Germany. We only know about the extermination camps. But what about all the others? About the 400,000 gypsies, about the homosexuals, about the communists. The concentration camps were opened not for the Jews. There were very few Jews. Those who were in there, the communist Jews, they were in 1933 and 1934 opened for the enemy of the state, as they called them. So it is a, and the first gassing was done with Russians. If you start off from there on there, and then, for example, the question is, why were the railways not bombed? Quite simply, of course, they had bombed the railways, they would have gone off by foot. You see, the Germans would have said, I'm sorry, the line is blocked, will you please go home to Budapest? Or they would have killed them on the spot there. But bombing a railway line, they would have unpacked and said, all right, all of you out, we repair it. They all would have done it. Nothing to do. It made no sense, you see. And if they say bombing camps, you would have killed some of the inmates. How can you bomb from... There was a very good conference on that, why Auschwitz was not bombed. Now, that is... This question comes to kids, but why didn't we bomb them? You have to be prepared for the answers. And so the whole question of, we have plenty of time, how we represent the Holocaust, must not be done by people who are pressing forward all the time the horrible fate of the Jews, which is a Shoah. The Shoah is a Jewish problem. The Holocaust is a European problem. And that Europe has to come to an answer with the, not the Shoah, that is murder. But the Holocaust, with all this, that is a European problem. And when I go to Germany, and I try not too often, I talk about this problem as the important problem, and say, I'm sorry, your people were killed. 70,000 children were killed because they were mentally, were injected in the Isar. They went there, please, in Hessen. Their people is a pilgrimage of people laying down flowers because thousands of children were executed by injections. Germans have nothing to do with Jews. Or when you talk about the treatment of girls who were caught in boarding schools and then had SS people kind of studs for Jewish Kinder. Those stories, if I tell that story in a school, I didn't say, no, let me look around. You, you would have been selected, offered to go to boarding school as a sort of honors. And you would have gone there, and then slowly would have found out what it's all about. And if you didn't want to take your child home, because you felt it was dishonorable, the child would have taken over by the stage. It's a special one, I would try to clear. That story would tell girls of 16. You don't need to talk about Belsen. Tell them that story. And I think that is important. And we have to bring things like that in the story. And if you take a class of girls around, you concentrate on that point. Yeah? And then you open up all this for afterwards. But that is teaching. Yeah? And the background for that, that I hope the Holocaust Museum will do.
About your contact with survivors after the war, with survivors from the camps.
In, it must have been end of 1947, I was approached by Oscar Friedman, who was a psychologist. Could I advise him what one could do with young people who had been rescued from concentration camps? Many of them were now in London and had adjusted themselves somehow to normal life, including having jobs or going to school. And he took me to a place in Belsize Park, which I knew because it had been a British rescue, as it was called, run by a woman called Mrs. Glucksmann. And it was completely equipped, kitchen and so on, for running a meal service. And those two houses, twin houses, belonged to the Jewish Refugee Committee. And they established there a hostel and wanted to know whether one could run a club for those boys. And I was asked, because I was very involved again in youth work in the baby clubs, could I advise? And the danger in life is that if you ask the advice, you will be caught. And Friedman was a psychologist and knew exactly how to use this. At the end, he said, "You said that and that and that and that. Why don't you do it? You can prove it to us that it can be done, but I doubt." So I agreed. And I was warden, they called it, for the boys who stayed in the house. And they had to sign their school reports. And I had to prepare something for building up the club. And that was great. Difficulty, because the Jewish Refugee Committee for the children rescued from the camps, it was called. With people like Leonard Montefiore, Lola Hahn Warburg, Mrs. Sif, and so others, opposed my approach when I said I only can take the job if this club is open to others as well. And they said we can't do that because according to the constitution the money we have raised must be spent on those children. I said yes, but this doesn't say whether in a direct or indirect way. And I must get those kids, that's my job then, to blend into a normal life.